we Americans think we can live with economies of type one. We all know socialism is bad, and it's better not to be a socialist. But if you are a socialist, we can get along with you as long as you're a socialist of the Western European type. But if you're a socialist of type two, then we got to fight with you. Why? We make this thing, well, it's a remarkable liberal to say, well, that's a socialist state, but it's not a communist state, and therefore they're not our enemy. Why should communist states be our enemy? Why should countries be enemies of the United States because they organize their economy primarily through the command technique? Well, I say we'll speculate on that Friday. The thing that I want to sort of, the lesson that I want to emerge for you this morning is that nations may not have much of a choice between one and two. That if they're determined to be socialist, their situation may dictate whether they go route one or route two. The stage of their economic development, the degree of national unity, political institutions and traditions, domestic pressures, international balance of power considerations, dominant ideologies, all help determine the economic system that a country will have. I just rattled off a long list of things. But in addition, the course of events in the economy, under either a market system or a command system, is going to exercise its own influence over the type of economy that a society has. Today, I want to show how this has worked out in Russia. Tomorrow, I want to show how it's worked out in the United States. I'm going to talk today about the evolution of the Bolshevik economy since 1917, when Lenin and the Bolsheviks seized power in Russia. And I'm going to concentrate on the recent reforms, the post-1965 reforms, of which many people are apparently quite unaware. To begin with, Lenin was very surprised to find himself in control in 1917. This was contrary to dogma. First, Russia was supposed to have passed through the capitalist stage of its development. But the Bolsheviks, who were convinced Marxist socialists, suddenly found themselves with the reins of power. And they didn't have complete control over this huge territory, which we call Russia. But they had control over the main centers of population. They were very tightly disciplined and well-organized and believed that they could extend their control and bring the whole country under their rule. Well, what do? As good Marxists, they should really have aided the evolution of capitalism, because Russia was still in the late stages of feudalism, or the early stages of capitalism. And this is what they did decide to do. They did not originally intend to set up a socialist state, but they intended to accelerate the development of capitalism and sort of go through the capitalist phase very rapidly. They take their castor oil quickly and purge themselves and then advance into the socialist state. But all of their plans were fouled up by the events of 1917 to 1920. Civil war, the Reds versus the Whites, Allied intervention, Allied armies were invading Russia for all kinds of very complicated reasons, including that the Bolsheviks had repudiated the debts of the Tsar, and the Allied countries were not too happy about that, and they thought maybe a little invasion will cause them to change their mind. So civil war, Allied intervention, and the aftermath of World War I, in which Russia had lost a large number of men and had been forced to sign a very unfavorable treaty. All of these things helped leave the country in chaos. And there wasn't much time to plan any kind of economic system. There were some radical reforms designed to please the peasant. In a city like St. Petersburg or Leningrad, where the workers had seized the factories, just taken them over, they were sort of allowed to maintain control, and plans were set up for integrating factories in different cities and coordinating the production of all kinds of things. But it was very much of a hit-and-miss proposition. It's almost impossible to call it any kind of economic system. It was characterized more by its non-systemness than anything else. Historians today usually refer to this as the period of war communism. By 1921, the Civil War was over, the Allies had gone home, the Bolsheviks had consolidated their control over the country. Lenin and the Bolsheviks sat down and took a look at what had happened and noticed that output, agricultural and manufacturing output in Russia had fallen disastrously. This is not to be attributed necessarily to the economic system. It can be attributed to just everything that was going wrong, the chaos and confusion in the country. In order to get back to the position from which they had started, they adopted what is known as the New Economic Policy. This was a return to capitalism. Now, certain land that had been confiscated from large landlords was not returned to the landlords. But the peasants to whom the land had been given, including some rather wealthy peasants, large landholders, were allowed to retain their land and do with it as they pleased. There was a great deal of reliance on markets and prices. Owners of property that had not been seized by the workers, owners of means of production, were allowed to retain their ownership of those means of production and produce and sell for whatever they could get. This was a relatively successful policy. It at least brought the Russian economy back to the level at which it had been prior to World War I. Now, during this period, Lenin died. There was a contest for power from which Stalin emerged as at least first among equals. By 1928, he was first among equals. It took him several years to establish the fact that he was absolutely first and there were no equals. But in the years after Lenin's death, and while Stalin was consolidating his power through his position as Secretary General of the Communist Party, there was a very heated and prolonged debate among Russian politicians and economists and engineers and everybody else called the Great Industrialization Debate. It was assumed by everyone that Russia had to, that Russia was surrounded by enemies. You see, they had expected that after World War I, Germany, England, and many of the other leading industrial nations of Europe would have their own socialist revolutions. They had reached the stage of mature capitalism. All of the contradictions of capitalism were now apparent, and capitalism was supposed to collapse. The proletarians were supposed to take over. But it didn't work out that way. These countries remained capitalistic, and that meant they remained enemies. So Russia found herself isolated. And she was going to have to lean on her own resources for quite some period of time. We couldn't tell how long it was going to be. She could not depend upon international trade to satisfy her need for heavy industrial equipment, for military equipment. She was going to have to become kind of sufficient unto herself. Now, what should she do? There were many different positions, but the two main ones that emerged were Stalin's and, you might say, Trotsky's, though Trotsky's position was much more complicated than this. The non-Stalinist position, let me call it that, was that Russia is going should concentrate on developing her agriculture and see what happens after that. Sort of let manufacturing take care of itself for a while, but focus on the development of agriculture and, to some extent, to the satisfaction of basic consumer needs. The Russian people were in pretty desperate straits. They were living poorly, eating poorly, and so it was kind of a, you know, just a humanitarian impulse on the part of some of the Bolshevik leaders. Let's get the people what they need, food, clothing, shelter. Stalin, and apparently a majority of the Bolsheviks, felt that this was a mistake, that the thing to be done was to build up the base for an industrial society. Stuff like steel mills, railroads, dams, capital equipment items that could not be expected to yield any benefits for the standard of living for a long period of time. The as many of the resources of the Russian economy as could be spared were to be focused on the development of heavy industrial equipment. Well, Stalin won. In 1928, the new economic policy was abandoned, and Russia entered upon her period of five-year plans. It was called officially Building Socialism in One Country. Now, these plans, well, let me just try to briefly characterize a Stalinist-type economy. That's what it came to be known as. It was characterized by relatively few high-priority targets. The Communist Party, or the Central Committee of the Communist Party, would decide on a few high priority targets, things we've got to do this year, things we've got to do this month, and things we have to do in the next 5 years. These targets were not to be missed, no matter what, no matter who you had to kill, no matter what you had to sacrifice, no matter how many people starved to death, these basic targets had to be reached. We'll see later why it was so important for them, why this, in a way, was fortunate for them. Then, the party having laid down the basic priority targets, they would turn their proposals over to GOSPLAN, State Planning Agency, composed of engineers, economists, mathematicians, statisticians, and party hacks. And this group would sort of try to put flesh and bones on them, flesh and blood, I don't know, anyway, fill out the plan, provide some detail. But in the process of trying to fill in detail, they needed a lot of information which they could only get from the lower echelons of the industrial apparatus. So the plan would go down to the bottom, you know, would filter down all the way down to factory managers. Come on in. These factory managers would fill in data like how big their factories are, how many machines they got, what they can produce. They would object to suggestions coming down from upstairs. Then they would send the plan back up to GOSPLAN. Then the central planners would look at it again and send it back down. It would go back and forth several times between the top and the bottom, trying to make it realistic. Now, there were five-year plans, which were not operational plans. I mean, those tried to set broad targets. There were annual plans, which were sometimes operational. And when I say operational, I mean that a factory director, an enterprise director, would sometimes have to open the one-year plan in order to see what he should do today. Quarterly plans, which were usually operational plans. These were the plans that usually guided the enterprise director from day to day. And then monthly plans, which were a kind of a check, like regular quizzes in a class. Your monthly plan, sort of something you looked at to see whether you were doing a good job and whether you were likely to come up to what was expected of you. Now, as you can imagine, there were all kinds of delays in this process. Very often the plan wouldn't come out until well after the planning period had been entered. So it may be June of 1965 before you find out what you should have been doing in January of 1964. The delay is much longer than this sometimes occurred. Moreover, there were all sorts, of course, unrealisms in the plan. Guy was told, the enterprise director is told he has to produce something, and in order to produce this, he absolutely needs a certain input, and this input is not available. It just is not available. He can't get any input. Well, obviously, he's not going to do it. He's going to have to fudge around somewhere and try to figure out some way that he can satisfy the plan. One other thing I want to mention about Stalinist-type planning. The basic method of control was something called planning by material balances. This dominated Russian economic planning until 1965, and it really still dominates it today in practice, though not in theory any longer. Planning or production can be thought of as a matter of using inputs to get outputs. Now, the outputs of an industry become the inputs for other industries. So you can sort of think of the economy as divided into all kinds of sectors. The steel industry, oil, coal, you can add barbering industry, you can add all kinds of consumer goods industries. You put them all up here and think of these as producing outputs. Each industry produces outputs. Now, in order to produce those outputs, each of these industries needs inputs, which is going to get from other industries. Thus, the steel industry, this is the steel industry here, and it's supposed to produce a certain amount of output. In order to do it, it's going to have to get inputs from this same list of industries, or some of them. Well, the Russians tried to plot this all out, and then allocate material balances to the right industry. Can you imagine how complicated a task this is? Huh? And just suppose they've got it all planned. What they were going to do, they passed out allocation permits so that a factory was supposed to produce locomotives. All right, what does it need to produce locomotives? It needs nuts and bolts, steel plates, boilers, and whistles. I leave with that. But suppose those, you know, these are the things that are, and then they put the locomotive together, see. Well, now, that means that in your plan, you're going to, you have a locomotive industry here. It produces X number of locomotives. So it needs a certain quantity of whistles, a certain quantity of plates, a certain quantity of nuts and bolts, and
boilers.
Okay. So you go to these industries, the nuts and bolts industry, the whistle industry, and you make sure that their planned output is sufficient to satisfy the locomotive industry's demand for inputs. But of course, now you've got to make sure that, just take the whistle industry. What do they need? Ropes, reeds, I don't know. But so you got to go to the rope and reed industry and make sure that they've got enough. And then you're ready to begin. See, it's January 1st, 1928. Everybody ready? Okay, here are your allocation permits. Everybody, you can't get anything unless you've got an allocation permit. So you pick yours up and you're entitled to so many nuts and bolts, so many whistles. I just suppose there's a slip. the whole thing just, it's incredible. You wonder, how did it ever work? The answer is it didn't work. And yet it did, because there were certain high priority targets. So what happens if you're supposed to produce something and you don't have the inputs? You scrounge and you look and you complain, and if you're the director of a high priority factory, you get them from somebody else. He's running a low priority factory, he loses them, that's all. You just, certain goals can be sacrificed and others cannot. And they maintain tremendous tautness in the whole system. Everything was in short supply. And what they would always do is just take it away from something that was deemed less important and give it to something that was deemed more important. Of course, this didn't always work out quite right, because you might say, whistles. Whistles aren't important. What are whistles good for? That's a low priority thing. But suppose locomotives are high priority. Maybe you've run a locomotive without a whistle. I don't know. But this was the dominant system. Of course, I sketched it very, very briefly. This was the dominance. Oh, why don't I do this? Bibliography. If you're interested at all in this, there are several good books that describe it. One is a book by Alec Null called The Soviet Economy. The thing's designed for layman. It's a paperback book. Another one that I would recommend highly is Robert Campbell, paperback called Soviet Economic Power. It is two paperback books that give you a good overview of how things were done in Russia from 1928 to 1965. How did it work out? Well, after the Russians launched Sputnik, we did a lot of marveling about their economy. You know, until that time, we believed that communism doesn't work. But after Sputnik, we got the silly idea that it works a lot better than it does. From 1957 through about 61 or 62, there were an awful lot of comparisons of the Russian rate of economic growth with ours. And, you know, some of these extrapolations of growth rates into the future, proving that if they continue growing at their rate and we continue growing at our rate, they are going to pass us by 1991. And of course, what happens then is that, our morale collapses. Notre Dame loses to St. Olaf. Let's get a little perspective on this. For one thing, the Russian figures were inflated. The Russians, now their statistics are reliable if you know how to deflate them. So that there was some inflation of their growth rate. But more important than that, their growth rate was based on a low base. You know, it's easier for somebody, a little baby who's that big, to grow 100% than it is for somebody who's that big to grow 100%. The smaller you are, the easier it is to attain a certain percentage rate of growth. In addition, the Russians had the advantage of borrowed technology. For most of this period of time, say 28 to 65, they've been catching up. They've been able to borrow things from us. Take a look at how we do it in Western Europe and take it over if it works and ignore it if it doesn't work. They also overproduction was never a worry during this period. So they could just keep that machine going like crazy. They didn't have to worry about what to produce. They just produced anything that was in the plan. In other words, all their factories were operated at 100% of capacity. Now, sometimes they produced things that they probably shouldn't have produced, in the sense that if the resources devoted to the production of this item had been used to produce something else, they'd have been better off. In 1962, Khrushchev, right at the time, incidentally, that we were, right at the time that we were talking about how we're going to have to do something in our steel industry to keep up with the Russians because they're passing us, Khrushchev made a speech to the Supreme Soviet in which he pointed out that for many years the Russians had sunk so many resources into steel because they had a steel complex that now Russia had an overdeveloped steel industry. And then you say, overdeveloped? Don't they need more steel? Yes, they need more steel, but as Khrushchev pointed out, they need plastics and fertilizer far worse. And they had not put enough money into chemical industries, or not, rather enough resources. If they had built less steel capacity, they would have built more chemical capacity, and that's what they really needed. And it's sort of interesting. Here we were in the United States saying, let's build more steel to catch up with the Russians, and the Russians are saying, we've built too much steel. Another thing. The saving consumption ratio was a very important explanation for the rate of Russian economic growth. That is to say, about 30% of the Russian output was not allowed to get into the hands of consumers, but was siphoned off by the state through a variety of means so that it could be used to produce heavy industrial equipment, lay the base of the socialist economy. Well, if we were to save and invest at the rate at which they saved and invested, we'd have a much higher growth rate too, but we choose not to. In other words, that rate of growth was purchased at a cost. In view of the low standard of living of the Russian people through most of this period, they were required to make very, they were required to make sacrifices that they really felt. These sacrifices pinched. And as one of my old teachers used to put it, Stalin industrialized Russia by throwing one generation of Russians on the ash heap of history. Their demand for a higher standard of living was simply denied, and the things they produced were poured back into the economy. Okay, well now, having said this, to give you a little perspective on the Russian growth rate, try to suggest that their record is not as fantastic as we were supposing a few years ago, I want to talk about the bugs of the system and what happened as a result of these bugs, especially in the last couple of years. There have always been numerous bugs in the Stalinist economy, and agriculture is a veritable plague of locusts. I'm not even going to talk about agriculture. That's the great Achilles heel. I'm just going to focus on manufacturing, or mining and manufacturing and construction. After Stalin's death, approximately, these problems became increasingly serious. Most basically, I would say what was happening was this, that the Russian economy was outgrowing the command principle. The task of an economic system, recall, is to provide a method of cooperation, or to secure cooperation among people in using available resources to provide what they want. Well, the Russians used the command principle. They commanded cooperation. They told people what to do. A great bureaucratic system that worked relatively well when the Russian economy was relatively simple. And there were just a few high priority targets. But as the economy developed, as the method of command organization succeeded, the Russians found that it no longer worked. And the bugs multiplied apace. In fact, the problems increased more than in proportion to the square of the rate of economic growth. And I'll suggest a couple of reasons why in a moment. But the basic thing that you've got to see, and I think most people don't, is that you probably cannot solve the fundamental problems of an economic system once you have passed beyond a certain level of complexity in any way except through the use of markets. And the Russian economy, somewhere in the 1950s, passed the stage of complexity. Well, that stage of complexity. It got so large, complex, successful, if you will, that it was compelled to rely upon markets, but it didn't do so, and so it began to ravel and shake and collapse. Let's see why. In the first place, I guess you could say this, an economic system has to satisfy wants, okay? Whose wants? How do you determine which wants are to be satisfied? If you're going to forget the consumer, that's a relatively simple task. If you say, well, we're going to give the consumer what we think he ought to have, and you provide him with a relatively few things, then your task is simple. But the goal of socialism has always been to provide people with what they want. How do you decide what they want? How do you? There are a lot of people who think that you produce what people need. You just give them their, satisfy their basic needs. There ain't no such thing as a basic need. That's the trouble. People are different. If you're going to provide, if you're going to satisfy people's wants, you're going to have some method for determining the nature of those wants and the urgency of the wants. There is no practical method for doing this except markets. Let people vote in marketplaces. Give them dollars and let them vote, or rubles. Now, you don't have to give them unequal amounts of money. You could give everybody the same amount of money and let him vote in the marketplace. But however you decide to distribute the votes, you know, if everybody gets the same number or people are allowed different amounts of votes, you've got to use some method of voting like the market in order to decide what it is that people want. It's the only practical method that there is for getting the necessary information. Once you've decided, though, what you're going to produce, you've got to decide how to produce it. Again, there's a technocratic error that supposes that there's only one right way to produce everything. What's the best way to haul freight? Well, if you want to know that, you go ask a transportation engineer. He'll tell you what the best way is to haul freight, but that's not true. Think for a moment. Is a diesel engine or a steam engine more efficient? Let me ask somebody. Somebody who's likely to give me the wrong answer. Which is more efficient? Chief, which is more efficient, a diesel or a steam engine? That's right, of course. That's it. And a lot of other things, too. The United States uses diesels predominantly. Other countries don't. Is it because we're efficient and they're not? No, it's because what's efficient in one country is different from what's efficient in another country. Well, now, just take one basic thing. If coal is very abundant and oil is very scarce, you tend to use steam locomotives. It'll be more efficient. But that's not the end of this. Now, Russia, you see, had both coal and oil. So which is more efficient, steam or diesel? Well, it's going to depend upon, not upon just the general availability of coal and oil, but upon the availability to the railroad industry. And what does that depend upon? That depends upon other demands for coal and oil. So suppose that Russia generates most of her electricity in steam plants burning coal. That's going to use up coal and reduce the availability of coal to the transportation industry and therefore make the diesel engine relatively more efficient or economic. So you get back to something like this, and I'm just taking one factor out of hundreds. You decide how you want to generate your electricity. Hydroelectric stations or steam plants burning coal. And when you make that decision, that determines or helps determine your decision as to whether you pull your trains by diesel or steam locomotives. All right, now let's just try to work that one out. Suppose that you're the commissar for railroads. And shall we build a whole raft of diesel or a whole raft of steam locomotives? Well, you know that it's going to depend upon the availability of coal versus the availability of oil. And you also know that this is going to depend, one crucial factor, on whether you generate your electricity through falling water or through burning coal. Now, how are you going to generate your electricity? So you go to the commissar for the electrical industry, and he says, well, we are going to generate it at lowest cost. So you say, well, what's low cost? And he tells you hydroelectric. You say, okay, fine. So that everything is determined. I see, and you go ahead and put in diesel locomotives. No, wait a minute, excuse me, you put in steam. You saved all that coal. All right, but there was a, but now let's go back to the commissar of the electrical industry. How did he know that hydroelectric was a lower cost way of generating electricity than burning coal? He said lower cost, but costs are based on prices. Where did he get the prices from? In the early stages of the Russian economy, that is where they got them from. They borrowed them from Western Europe and the United States. They would look at, and some of them even admitted it. In fact, there's one Eastern European economist who has argued, he's shut up in recent years, but he's argued that socialism cannot exist without at least one capitalist country from which socialism can borrow its price ratios. This guy was probably one of the pioneers of the new reforms, and he's made his point, which is why he shut up. But you see, the prices which the commissar of the electric industry was using to decide which was a cheaper method of generating electricity were set maybe in Moscow and set arbitrarily. Or set on the basis of past experience, but that experience has changed. As resource availabilities and utilities of resources change over time, relative prices ought to change. But how do you know they ought to change, and how do you know how much they ought to change? You come back to the fundamental fact that you can't know unless you have markets. Markets are necessary to determine not only what people want and how urgently they want it, but markets are necessary to tell you what's available. Or let me put it this way. Markets are necessary so that all of the alternative uses for a product can express themselves in relation to all of the things that are available. And the prices which emerge from this interplay of all supplies and demands are called scarcity prices. They are prices that reflect, I wrote it down here, the availability in relation to the utility of everything in relation to everything else. This is not fair. You don't know the price for a thing because you know how much it's wanted. You got to know how much it's wanted relative to how much is available. But when you just know how much of something is available and how much it's wanted, you still don't know, because those things are going to be determined by how much of other things are available and how much they're wanted. A change in the availability of copper changes the demand for aluminum and also changes the supply of aluminum. Everything is dependent upon everything else. And what you really got to know is availability in relation to utility is everything in relation to everything else. How do you get this information? There is no practical way to get it except through the interplay of supply and demand in the marketplace. Okay. Now, this business of planning by material balances, another bug. How many different ways can you combine two letters, say A and B? How many different ways can you combine them? Two. And how many different ways can you combine three letters? Six. Or maybe you studied the new math, I have. Nine in the new math, six in my limited room. All right. How many different ways can you combine four letters? Yeah, 24. This is exactly what happens to planning by material balances as the economy grows. Your problem, the decisions you have to make, increase by more than the square of the rate of economic growth, and quickly get out of hand. you've got, I don't have it, or I wish I did, one of these big input-output charts that American economists have devised to try to describe the American economy. And there are some that are as large as this black one, or larger, in fact, real tiny. And they just divide the economy into major sectors. Then you would have to get a more detailed one than this, really, to make operational decisions about where you're going to allocate your materials. And I just suppose that something goes wrong. You get a fire in a coal mine, and it drops out of production. And now you've got to go through that chart and wiggle it all out, figure out how everything goes. Everything gets changed. The system of planning by material balances was breaking down completely in the 1950s. Plans were degenerating into wishful thinking. The planners would tell a factory what to do, tell the industry what to do, but the inputs that were essential for doing it never arrived. A measure of the extent to which material balances were breaking down was the rise, importance, and even acceptance of a group of men called Tolkachi. The English translation for this would be 5%ers, pushers. These became absolutely essential people in the Russian supply system. They were men who usually lived in Moscow, and they knew people. And the factory director called and said, look, we've got to this month get out so many doohickeys, but we can't do it without gewgaws. And our gewgaws are supposed to come from this factory up in Schmartzkopf, and they haven't arrived. Can you do anything? So he gets on the phone. He calls the guy in Schmartzkopf. And that guy's got no interest in hurrying them. He's got his own problems. He says, drop dead. So the Tolkachi knows somebody. He gets a hold of a buddy in the ministry who sends a word down, and all of a sudden that guy gets threatened, and he gets something on the train. Or he knows somebody else who's got a few extra gewgaws sitting around, or who is willing to make a few gewgaws available at a price. And these were the guys who, they were criminals, technically. And some of them got racked up, and for that reason they got relatively high salaries, too. They were paid out of the slush funds of the enterprises, largely. The only way, in fact, many Russians, it's now generally admitted in Russia, that the only way that the economy managed to operate in the late 1950s and early 60s was through the cleverness of these Tolkachi. And so some central planners looked at this and said, my gosh, that we aren't planning the economy anymore. It's completely out of control. We can't tell which way things are going. And the only way to save central planning is to plan less. We're trying to do so much that we're not succeeding in doing anything. Then there's the problem of success indicators. Plans can't specify everything. How is an enterprise director going to complete the plan? You can tell him, the example I gave the other day, to produce nails. But are you going to tell him, is somebody up in Moscow going to tell him exactly how many nails of each type to produce and when? And how? I mean, obviously, you have to leave room for decision down at the operating level. Even the little production line worker has to make some decisions. The foreman has to make decisions. Low management people, middle management people, all the way up. Everybody's got some decisions to make. Well, how are these people to decide? Well, the answer is patriotically. But what does patriotism require? Is it patriotic to use more labor and fewer machines, or vice versa? Is it patriotic to produce in the plant or buy it from an outside supplier? Is it a good thing to introduce a certain innovation with attached risk that it might not work, or to forget about the innovation and follow the safe and certain path? Who knows? There was a great stress on quotas. This was the big thing by which the enterprise director lived and by which he was saved if he was saved. Meet your quota. Usually monthly quota and sometimes quarterly and annual quotas. Fulfill your quota and if possible overfulfill it, and the enterprise director's salary might go up 40%. Fail to fulfill your quota and you were likely to be demoted, or even worse during the Stalinist period. Well, this, as you can suppose, led to manifest waste. The big thing is, well, you look at it this way. We've got to produce so many motorcycles. We've got to have these motorcycles out by Thursday. Otherwise, we're not going to meet our quota. If we don't meet our quota, boom, the roof caves in. And I, as the enterprise director in charge of the plant, am going to get sent to another plant at a much lower job. So what do I care about what happens next year as a result of the decision that I make to meet my quota this year? I'm just going to meet that quota. And so you borrow production from next year. You take highly skilled engineers who are busy drafting designs for future improvements in the plant. You pull them off of their workbenches and you put them down there in the factory doing common assembly line work. It's extremely wasteful, but it's the thing to do, obviously, if you got to meet your quota. Well, there was all kinds of wasted materials and wasted manpower and the doing of things that were obviously inefficient. And so the Russians, in order to counter this, started introducing all kinds of success indicators. In other words, you not only had to meet your quota, but you also had to fulfill such success indicators as these. Cost reduction. Meet your quota, but this year reduce your cost a certain percentage below last year. Reduce labor time. Now notice these things may come in conflict. Reduce machine time, and that of course may conflict too. You get points, brownie points is really what they were, for innovation. But of course this is very vague. What if an innovation's no good? There are also some brownie points for making more than planned profits. See, the Russians planned certain profits and they planned losses in certain industries, and if you do better than you were supposed to do, you get brownie points. Brownie points for conserving materials. In some industries, there were dozens of these success indicators, so that every time the planners would find that an enterprise director, in order to meet the goals set before him, was engaging in some practice that was probably wasteful and inefficient, they would stick in a new success indicator. And the success indicators multiplied all over the place. Well, what happened? As a result, enterprise directors were maximizing the brownie points after a while and spending all of their energies scoring well on the brownie point scale instead of doing what they were supposed to be doing. It's sort of like a student memorizing dates for an examination. I mean, the grade is the success indicator, and he may know that memorizing dates is not a good way to spend his time, but he won't be spending any more time in the institution if he doesn't memorize the dates, so he memorizes the dates. Let me give some examples, and these are all taken from Soviet literature. Chandelier problem. Many visitors to Russia commented on the large number of beautiful, ornate, heavy chandeliers throughout Russia. Maybe you've seen pictures of them, even in the department stores, these beautiful chandeliers. Why? Khrushchev has told us, because for years, the quota for chandeliers was stated in tons. The sheet music problem. Maybe you don't think of sheet music industry as having a quota, but they do. They've got a quota. Now think of what happens when you've got the sheet music industry has to fulfill its socialist quota. 100 pieces of music per month. What if nobody's writing any decent tunes? You grind them out anyway. The one very interesting problem was described by an engineer. The conflict between the builder of an airplane and the user of an airplane. One case, and this is an actual case, I can't get some of the details a little wrong. Someone discovered that in building planes, airplanes, commercial airplanes, for heavy freight mostly, it was possible by eliminating some drilling operation after stamping to conserve labor time, save some materials, some metal, economize on machine tool use, and introduce an innovation, and increase profits, all of these things. And all of these satisfied success indicators, and it was obviously a good thing for the enterprise to do. And so they did it. And the engineer estimated that the total saving to the Russian economy ran to about 10,000 rubles a year through this little innovation. But as a consequence of the innovation, the carrying capacity of the airplane was reduced, and the cost to Aeroflot ran to something like 100,000 or 400,000, I believe it was, rubles per year. So that the user of the airplane pays an extra 400,000 rubles, whereas the builder of the airplane saves 10,000 rubles. Will the builder of the airplane do it? Yes, he will. He doesn't know what will happen in Aeroflot. And if he does know, he doesn't care. Well, he cares, but his own skin comes first. He's not going to get canned because Aeroflot isn't making any profit. He's going to get canned if his factory isn't making any profit. Well, how do we avoid this in America? Why doesn't Boeing introduce some cost-saving operations that will inflict a burden upon American and Delta? Delta doesn't use American. Well, American and United or whoever. And the reason is that American and United will soon stop buying Boeing airplanes. But you don't have any choice in Russia. The Aeroflot bought its airplanes from the factory that the planners up there said they were supposed to buy it from and setting up the plan of material balances. The spare parts problem. People commented for years on the absence of spare parts in Russia. Why? Because for a long time, plans were stated in gross value terms. All right.
Now, just suppose what this means. Suppose that you're producing motorcycles. You buy 50% of the motorcycle from somebody else, and then you assemble it. So that here's one part of the motorcycle that you buy. Here's the front part of the motorcycle that you build. Now, for every motorcycle that you crank out, you get credit for what you built plus what you just got from somebody else. So, you obviously are getting more credit for this wheel than this wheel. See, this wheel you built all by yourself, and you're getting credit just for the work that you've done. But you're also getting credit for this wheel, even though you didn't build it. So you always have an incentive never to send out a back wheel except attached to a front wheel. So you couldn't get spare parts for motorcycles or anything else in Russia because the manufacturer has an incentive not to produce spare parts. He wants to produce parts and attach them to full machines and then send them out. And of course this makes a mess. Lots of expensive equipment had to be it stood idle because there were no spare parts available. The quality clothing problem, same sort of thing problem. Because the producers of apparel were getting credit for gross value, they would use expensive cuts of clothing, expensive cuts of cloth, expensive textiles, that's what I want to say. They'd get more credit. Now that's enough of the problems. Khrushchev tried regional decent, in order to try to meet these problems, the whole thing was, the system was degenerating into chaos. Khrushchev introduced regional decentralization in 1957, a huge reform. This failed miserably, because that wasn't the problem. Decentralization is what they needed, but not regional decentralization. He set up about 100 regional economic ministries. And instead of administering the whole thing from Moscow, we'll administer it from 100 centers around the country. And what you kind of got was 100 competing little divisions, all trying to slit one another's throat. Khrushchev's basic answer to this was nagging. He thumped his shoe and he nagged and he preached and he screamed. He saw what was going wrong, but he didn't know what to do to correct it. And the fundamental reason that Khrushchev was eased out was because he had no ideas about this problem. But meanwhile, a few engineers, mathematicians, and economists were proposing something that they called profitability plus planning. First quietly, and then from 1962 to September of 1965, more vociferously, and after September 1965, quite dogmatically, because it's now official dogma. And I just got a couple more minutes here. Can I finish this?
Sure.
The gist of the new proposal is this. Let the central planners command just a few critical areas. Let them hand down orders about what we should produce and how, and just a few crucial areas. And let them lay down very broad directives and goals. But let the enterprise directors, the factory managers, fulfill the general plan. Let them fill in all the details. In accord with what criteria? Let them maximize their profit. This has become known as the system of material incentives. They've toyed with all kinds of words for it, phrases for it, the system of material incentives. And as one leading Russian academician has put it, this new system of material incentives is in accord with the Leninist principle that profitability is the best guide to production in a socialist state. That's quoted from Pravda, which is the Russian word for truth. The Central Committee of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union in September 29th, 1965, resolved the debate that had been going on for two or three years on this question of whether profitability plus planning was a reversion to capitalism or whether it was the next step in socialism. It resolved the debate by deciding that it was the next step of socialism. This has now become official party dogma. But a big problem remains. Profitability is a correct guide if actual prices are scarcity prices. But if the prices on the basis of which managers act so as to maximize profits are arbitrary, then their decisions will be arbitrary. Managers need information in order to make rational, efficient, patriotic socialist decisions. If the information they have is faulty or arbitrary or meaningless, and they respond to this information, they will be making arbitrary and frequently erroneous decisions. In the United States, profitability is a good guide to a manager, a good guide to what ought to be done and when and how and so on, because he's determining profitability on the basis of prices that are determined by supply and demand. And that means prices that reflect the availability in relation to utility of everything in relation to everything else. This is not the case in Russia. Since 1965, on orders from the Central Committee, a debate and discussion has been going on about price determination. The Russians have known that they must revise their system of prices if they're going to institute successfully these new economic reforms. The consensus is, in Russia, that some method of setting prices is needed that will reflect resource availabilities, alternative uses for resources, the productivity of various technologies, the effects of technological change, state demand, and consumer demand. Now, I happen to know only one method for getting such information, and that is free markets, through which supply and demand determine prices. Without this, the economic reforms of last year and this year may be simply out of the frying pan and into the fire. The problem, it is important to note, is not basically one of incentive. The problem is fundamentally one of information. The Russian decision makers, the people down there where the water hits the wheel, do not have adequate information. Neither do the planners up at the top, for that matter. Now, the question then is whether the USSR is going to go this route, whether it is going to allow its prices to be determined through the interplay of supply and demand in free markets, or whether it is going to continue doing as it is now doing, basically, setting these prices upstairs on the basis of what's customary, whim, the intuition of a planner, and so on. And on Friday, I'm going to raise the question, what will happen if they do or don't? And that's going to be speculative, of course. First, speculate on whether they will or not. And I'm going to conclude that they're not. They are not going to go the market route, finally. And then what will happen if they don't? Well, then we'll speculate what will happen if they do, too, because I may be wrong on that. What we've seen, though, in reviewing the USSR experience is the limitations of the command technique for securing cooperation in a society and using available resources to satisfy wants. The command technique works, but it has very definite limitations, and it can do very little to secure cooperation in an economy where there is any complexity and development to speak of. I would say any economy in which the per capita standard of living exceeds a couple of $100 per year, such an economy is too complex to be organized via the command principle. If nonetheless, for some reason, people decide to organize it via the command principle, they are going to create chaos. Planning doesn't always lead to order. fighting sometimes leads to chaos. Well, tomorrow I want to leave Russia alone, turn to the United States, and suggest that we are evolving in just the opposite direction. That we are moving from a system in which information is available to a system in which information is arbitrary and meaningless. All with the best intentions in the world, of course. So if we meet the Russians, we will meet them in chaos. Okay. Yeah. Does somebody want to ask a private question? Somebody want to ask a public question? Yeah.
In the early part, the economy was actually producing impersonal items, the heavy industry. Mm-hmm. And when they're really getting into trouble is when they're trying to produce personal items. Forms of clothing, homes, which is like an air appliance, etc. Right?
But not just that. Also, as they've been more successful in producing what you call impersonal items, and they produce more impersonal items, greater quantities and greater varieties, remember, they've gotten into the problem there too. But as soon as they try to produce personal items, the problem gets really out of hand.
Another question on that, like you say, the Russians putting up their Sputnik and also beating up a lot of his rockets. Don't you think it's the idea that with us, we've got to wait for General Electric, Westinghouse, Boeing, and all of these to get their mix into the money? But Russia says, you do that, and go ahead and do it. And that's all there is to it. There's no money involved in there.
Yeah.
In their system, but always we've got to wait till everybody gets the finger to five.
Yeah. If you've got a few in a country, a few high priority targets, if we thought that putting a Sputnik up was as important as the Russians obviously thought it was in 1955-56, we'd have had one up before. But we didn't think it was that important. We weren't willing to order people all around and order resources and tell somebody, you can't have this because these resources are needed for that. I mean, we have more resources and we have as many brains as they have. And I'm sure we could put anything up faster than them if we're willing to pay the cost. They were. We weren't. I'm glad we weren't, personally. But yeah.
Two things. One of the things that constantly keeps cropping up in the American and economic press is the story of the gulag. I mean, if I got this right, how does that, whatever happened to them, relate to the economic situation?
Well, that gets into the agriculture problem. Stalin determined to collectivize agriculture. He realized that he couldn't industrialize the country unless he had enough food for workers, manufacturing workers in the cities. And so they hoped to get it by buying it from the peasant. But the peasant wanted high prices, and he could get high prices, and Stalin wasn't willing to pay those high prices, because if the peasant got the high prices, he would then use that money to purchase the manufactured goods, and those manufactured goods then would not be available for what Stalin wanted them for. So his technique was compulsory deliveries. You've got to deliver. The peasant has to deliver food to the city at certain prices, very low state prices. Well, the peasant refused to cooperate. And with hundreds of thousands of peasants, it's very difficult. So Stalin decided, well, the only thing to do is collectivize them, because then we can coerce them better. The basic reason for collectivization was the ease of coercion. And then he found it difficult to collectivize them. He had to coerce them to collectivize them. And, of course, in the fight, it got pretty bloody. And the kulak was the particular victim of the whole thing. It's very difficult to launch a government program against farmers. But you can more easily launch a program against wealthy, predatory, speculative, land-grabbing farmers. Now, that turns out to be any farmer who doesn't go along with the policies of the state. But if you... There are relatively few big peasants, these are the kulaks, largely, and you get them, you nail them, you chop off their heads, you send them to Siberia and take their land and tell the peasant, now come into our collective and see all this extra land you get. And maybe you bribe some peasants in that way. The kulak was a particular victim, but the peasant, it turned out, was even hard to bribe. Because he said, fine, I'll take that land, but I don't want to enter your collective.
Would you say that most of the internal problems in the Eastern world are primarily economic? Destalinization, was that economics, as also the easing of the future, and the China-Russia problem, is that an economic one primarily? Or the black hole on the satellites, is that an economic problem?
No. I wouldn't say it's primarily in that.
Destalinization was not.
Not primarily in any. I just couldn't say primarily. No.
The China-Russia conflict
is not primarily economic, no, I don't think so. Well, I mean, it is in a sense. It's in this sense that the stage of economic development reached by China and Russia is one important factor in determining the different constellations of conditions in Russia and China that in turn have led to the possibility, the greatly increased possibility of conflict between Russia and China.
Well, revisionism is, of course, the dirtiest thing you can call somebody, and that's exactly what the Chinese are calling the Russians, and oddly enough, that's, according to your description, what the Russians are doing.
Well, yeah, but there's revisionism isn't just this kind of economic reform. Revisionism includes also attitudes toward the capitalist world, foreign policy.
It wasn't a part of, wasn't this problem complicated in trying to get the most out of the system? If you were to promote a talented factory operator on up the ladder, first you'd have to be a good communist before you could promote it. If you weren't, you couldn't. And secondly, unless he supported that hierarchy, he'd eventually be a threat to them. So all this maneuvering is behind the scenes throughout their system.
Yeah, well, that was much more of a problem in the early years than it is today. Today, almost every Russian is a good communist, even if he's not a member of the party. There are most enterprise directors are members of the Communist Party. The few who are not are called, I forget what there's some title, like fellow traveler. non-party communist, I think that's it, a non-party communist or something. This was a serious problem for them in the early years, that the people who were trained to manage the factories were pretty sympathetic to non-socialist policies. And so that's one of the reasons why the Russians introduced this very peculiar thing that has characterized both their factories and their armies. A technician and a theoretician working together. If you saw Boris Pasternak, Dr. Zhivago, you know, this, maybe you didn't figure out what was happening here. These two guys, remember when Zhivago is kidnapped and taken off to serve as doctor for this troop of Bolsheviks around the country? There are two guys in command. One of them was the theoretician and the other was the military man. It was the task of the theoretician to make sure that the military man made politically correct decisions. And of course, this was kind of important in the early stages of the Bolshevik Revolution. But it leads to trouble. It's very difficult to run an army or a factory when you've got two heads. Yeah.
I thought at the time I really feel that this economic training was, you know, a higher step of socialism, and really kind of capitalism and called a new step in socialism in
I mean, I don't know. It requires psychoanalysis. There's a very interesting article on this, however. I can't offhand give you the exact source, but Time magazine in February 1965 or something, while this debate was at its height, ran an article, a cover article, on one of the leading Russian economists, Evsai Lieberman, and called him a prophet of capitalism. Lieberman indignantly responded, asked equal time. Time didn't give it to him, but several other magazines did. It was printed in Russia and in the United States. His response, and since that time, a lot of Russians, too, have answered the same question. Is it true, as the filthy bourgeois say, that we're going back to capitalism? No, no, a thousand times no. They haven't developed a single answer yet on why what they are doing is not a return to capitalism, but I think we can see one emerging. And the answer that is emerging is that capitalism is an elemental, unplanned, uncoordinated system in which you just assume that if every pig goes after his own. We got to stop talking this way about pigs. If everybody just goes out and seeks his own interest, the good will emerge. Not so. Socialism says that the good only emerges when those who understand history and the will of the people set the basic direction of society. But once a socialist state has passed through the early stages of development, it now becomes possible to enter upon the second stage of socialism, which has a good deal of markets and profitability and financial and material incentives and all of this. And the third stage, presumably, is where everything is produced in such abundance that you don't need any guides for anything. Everybody does what he wants to do. And then we're back to an elemental system, I guess. But that is the basic difference that they seem to be carving. In the United States, there is nobody up at the top who understands the will of the party and the needs of the country and the direction of history. We just drift, blind drift. But in a socialist society, there is the party, which understands and gives basic direction and thrust to society and makes some crucial decisions, like pollution and things like this. All right. On Friday, I'm getting this a little bit, you see, because we'll be talking about is the evolution of the American and the Russian system, the simultaneous evolution, grounds for believing that the East-West conflict, at least insofar as it's a U.S.-Russia conflict, will cool down. And then we're going to get into this. Is it true, as Time magazine says, that we're all becoming sort of humane capitalists or capitalistic socialists? We'll try to answer that question.
Are they still maintaining the atheistic attitude completely?
Well, it's still the official attitude, but this fluctuates, and it varies very much from region to region in Russia. Sometimes there's official encouragement of religion in Russia. There have even been some people who, in publications, have argued that the Russian stance is one of neutrality. We don't support religion, but we don't attack it either, because to attack religion is to support a religion. Now that's that beginning to sound very much like the Baptist principle of separation of church and state. But that's not official. Official position is still atheism. But they're less, they're certainly much less defensive about it. They're much more tolerant. They've restored some churches and interesting museums. And they're talking about the great religious heritage of Russia. And there are some novels and plays being produced now with profound Christian overtones. Some examination of the role of Christianity in the history of Russia, and it isn't all opiate of the people, as it turns out. Christianity, especially the Russian version, Russian Orthodox Christianity, has provided powerful resources for the life of the Russian people. And they're drifting, shifting.
Will this trend lead to more incentives to the capitalistic system? Or, incentives for more productivity?
You mean the more Christianity, the more capitalism? I don't know. Even if I believed that, I wouldn't dare say in the presence of my wife. I don't know. We got to quit.